We're talking about anger in this hour, and there's a lot of vitriol out there these days. Partisan sniping on social media, screaming matches on cable news, not to mention the early morning tweet storms from certain elected officials. Frankly, it's exhausting. Also infuriating, blood-boiling, and maddening, so why can't we just let it go? Maybe because we as a nation are addicted to anger. At least that's what science fiction writer and astrophysicist David Brin believes. In fact, he wrote an open letter to addiction researchers and psychologists asking them to investigate America's epidemic of self-righteous indignation.
The big picture on addiction is very, very simple. We have an ability to be addicted because it helps us to survive. We get addicted to our children, and that helps us to be decent parents and put in the work. We get addicted to music and joyful things and our friends. What heroin and other drugs do is they hijack this reward system. And the worst, most destructive habit that releases the same chemicals, endorphins and kephalins, dopamine, is self-righteous indignation.
Okay, explain this, because I think most people would not think of self-righteous indignation as releasing a pile of neurochemicals that we'd find addictive.
Well, think about it. So many other mental states can be addictive. This is absolutely proved. Why not a mental state that has helped people throughout thousands of years to be strong in the face of anger? If you're self-righteously indignant, you have the power and will to pick up that spear, to pick up that sword, to pick up that legal brief, and go into combat. Self-righteousness and indignation aren't all bad. Sometimes they're called for. The people who marched with Martin Luther King, for example, the people who fought back against Hitler. But the problem is that whenever you enter a mental state that's addictive, you have a tendency to go back to it, and then back to it, and then back to it again. And if I asked your listeners to look into a mirror and be honest, whether or not they've ever been really, really indignant, of course everybody, if they're honest, would raise their hands. But then the second question is, didn't it feel good? Didn't it feel good to be so righteous, to be so right, to know that you're among the lonely few who know what's going on and fighting against the oppressors? Anybody left or right in our country would have to admit, yeah.
But the thing I don't get is why you think that's actually physically addictive or pleasurable. Do people really enjoy being angry?
Oh, well, now, Anne, if after this interview is over, please look in a mirror and try to remember some of the times when you were righteous, when you knew you were right. And authority figures were so wrong.
David, I'm afraid that's every day.
Yes, and there's a voluptuousness to it.
So this is a little scary because you're talking about neurochemical pathways that we've turned into superhighways. How are we supposed to change that?
Well, I think that it's terribly important that we recognize that there are powers on the left and the right and all over the spectrum that want us afraid because then we're more easily manipulated. And a fearful mind is more resistant to facts. And we've been seeing this in our culture where it's really hard to refute anything if the clinging to your side's point of view is boosted by not only self-righteousness, but fear.
I was going to say that, you know, the addiction analogy only goes so far. I mean, for instance, while self-righteousness maybe can be irritating and annoying, it's not like it's killing people, you know, like an opioid epidemic. So is this dangerous?
Well, tell that to the poor Sikh gentleman who was shot dead in his driveway by someone who indignantly and self-righteously thought he was an enemy because he wore a turban. No, I'm not claiming that self-righteousness is directly responsible for as much death as heroin, but I think it's responsible for far more damage in that it destroys our ability to see the commonalities in each other, to recognize that the indignant and self-righteous person at the other end of the spectrum is responding to the same mythologies, the same suspicion of authority, the same caveman fears, all these things that come together in a mishmash that has destroyed the ability of the one republic that ever existed on the face of the earth that was based on logic, that was almost Vulcan in its belief that we can negotiate, compare facts, and come up with reasonable compromise solutions. That's what our parents in the Greatest Generation did when they overcame depression and Hitler and contained communism and built fantastic industries and a mix of government and private enterprise. The greatest generation would be ashamed of us right now for being so illogical.
Well, you could also say this country was founded by deeply self-righteous, indignant people. I mean, you know, think about the American Revolution.
Well, I actually disagree with that. Usually when there is a revolution, one elite is using the populist fervor of the masses against another. And we saw it get carried away exactly 100 years ago in Russia. We saw it get carried away in the French Revolution when wealth disparities were similar to America today. But the American Revolution was stage managed by very, very logical men and women. It was the calmest and most bourgeois and reasonable and moderate revolution. And that is what we should be militant and self-righteous in defending. We should be militantly defending a moderate revolution that has reformed itself incrementally over years. Each generation of Americans has taken on another of our faults, slavery, and then civil rights, and so on. And it's been incremental.
Well, I think surely there are some benefits to anger. As you said, the civil rights movement wouldn't have happened without self-righteous indignation. Protests over climate change wouldn't have happened. So much that's good and so much social change and social justice happens or begins with self-righteous indignation.
I absolutely agree. We have to look at all of the things, as the anthropologist Sarah Hurdy has pointed out. We should neither ignore what we were for a million years, cave dwellers, mammoth hunters, and then living in feudalism. We should neither ignore our background nor let it limit us. And it would be ignoring our background to ignore the fact that many, many of our steps of progress were fueled by indignation. We should have this as one of our mental suites, mental states that we can get into when something is very wrong. But when it reaches the point where it's a drug that you can't say no to, that you can't walk away from and take a vacation from, that you can't calm down and sit down with people on the other side, here is the huge mistake. Look, I approve of a lot of the marching that's going on. Resistance, all that kind of thing. I guess I'm giving away my politics. But it's not going to be anywhere near as effective as finding just 5 to 10 million brainy, smart, and at their core sane conservatives who know something's wrong and sitting down and talking to them.
What's the dividing line for you? I mean, what's the difference between indignation as a moral virtue and indignation as a drug?
When you can, in the course of your actions, calm down enough to put indignation aside, then you know it's less an addiction and more a choice. When you're able to look in the mirror and say, I can see that this feels real good, and that's one of the reasons I'm doing this. And I am going to downplay that as my main reason for being active in my political cause. When you notice that it's preventing you from listening to someone sincere who has a suggestion that doesn't fit your stereotypes, if it's preventing you from pragmatically mapping out how to achieve your goals, then it's counterproductive.
What if you go back to thinking of trying to balance, substitute one pleasure for another? Because you began by talking about this kind of indignation as addictive, and addictive because there is something very pleasurable about it. I'm not sure that trying to be a sane and rational and self-questioning person is quite as pleasurable as feeling absolutely certain that you're right. So what's another kind of pleasure that you could substitute?
Well, absolutely, but we do have examples. Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and especially Ronald Reagan were able to tap into not just indignation against injustice, but also hope, a carrot to go along with the stick. And there's so much to be hopeful about in our world. It's completely loony that we should be in this state of wrath when the last 70 years of the American pacts for all of our mistakes have been the greatest era in the history of humanity, with the most development, with the greatest peace. And we should be bragging about that, because only by bragging about that can we prevent some forces from saying everything we've done is a mistake. Let's try the old ways, the old feudalist ways, the old ways of thumping power. You know, we've done some things that are good, and we should brag about those in between the screams of denunciation.
David, thank you so much. That was great.
Oh, terrific. I hope we all just find some joy and become happy warriors.
Science fiction writer David Brin.